I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up today, we'll hear from a family member of a dissident just detained in Iran. We'll hear from a soldier who had to grow up fast to go to war. We'll hear how the economy made its way into New Yorker magazine cartoons. But first, how is President Obama doing on all of these fronts? War, the economy, Iran. And let's throw in his reaction to the would-be underwear terrorists. Also, healthcare, climate change, and that whole let's bring the Olympics to Chicago thing. The president is wrapping up his first year in office. How'd he do? The far right has called him a socialist. The far left has accused him of compromising on issues like Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the public option. We asked Time Magazine's Joe Klein to weigh in. And by the way, if you'd like to weigh in as well, you can tweet us at Here and Now or email us at letters@hereandnow.org with your questions for Joe Klein as we welcome him. Joe, welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
And this month you gave President Obama one of your Teddy Awards for political courage. This is the award named after Teddy Roosevelt. It's nonpartisan. You also say Republican Lindsey Graham was a contender this year and has won in the past. But make the case for giving it to Barack Obama.
Well, he has, first of all, he was faced with one of the most difficult situations that any American president has ever faced coming into office. You know, the prospect of a depression, two wars overseas, issues like global warming and a host of others. And he faced these, you know, front on. He didn't duck away. He went after all of them, and in ways that were complicated and nuanced and not guaranteed, you know, and guaranteed not to increase his popularity in the short term, but perhaps in the long term.
But the fact that he took on so much is one of the things that he's criticized for, and the fact that in just about every case he didn't come through with perhaps what he would have wanted to. So you have people like Jonah Goldberg in the L.A. Times saying that the sizzle doesn't match the steak. You have Barack Obama winning a Nobel for Peace as he, as Jonah says rightly, sends troops to war. You have Barack Obama promising oceans would stop rising but delivering what Jonah calls a non-binding something or other in Copenhagen.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I'd agree with your premise. I think that...
That's Jonah's premise.
What?
That's Jonah's premise.
No,
yeah.
But your premise before that, which was that that what Obama has come through with are not the sort of solutions he'd want. Ah. I think especially in foreign policy, he is proceeding exactly as he wants to. Hasn't always gotten the results that the world would want, but he has completely turned around what I believe to be a really destructive Bush era policy, you know, the unilateralism, the shoot first and try to negotiate later. I think that even on issues like Iran, where clearly the regime is not cooperating, Obama's willingness to talk has united the world and put the Iranian regime in a very defensive position that it wasn't in, you know, a year ago.
Well, that's true. You do put that on your list, along with putting billions into the economy to save it from free fall, sending 50,000 more troops to Afghanistan.
And he's on the brink of passing the most monumental piece of social legislation in my lifetime.
The health care reform. But I guess, you know, and you're right, Joe, because I said maybe not what he wanted. Perhaps what I should have said is what many of his early supporters thought he might have wanted. For instance,
no, that's not true either.
Oh well, I'm talking about, for instance, the people who are upset that there's no public option. Let's say.
Well, you know, the left blogosphere is upset, but the left blogosphere confuses itself with the Democratic Party's base. In the Republican Party, the ideological right wing is the party's base. In the Democratic Party, the ideological left wing isn't the base. The base is African Americans, it's Jews, it's union members, it's women, it's Latinos. And they are not ideological extremists. You know, most of them don't care about the public option, which was, in truth... You know, what happened there was a classic example of why politics is so difficult nowadays. You had a uniting of both the left and right, their activist groups. Their focus groups told them that government takeover of healthcare was something that they could use to rouse their troops. For the left, it was the prospect of a public option. The reality of a public option was that it wasn't going to affect more than 1 million people. The health care reform bill is going to affect 30 million people. It's going to transfer $200 billion a year to the working poor to help them pay, to subsidize, their insurance premiums. That's more than welfare, food stamps, the earned income tax credit, housing, and daycare vouchers combined.
That's
a huge thing. And what we have is, extremist the extremist politics of dilettantism on the left and phony populism on the right, and it's making it very difficult for the vast majority of the country to get the progress that it needs.
That's Joe Klein of Time Magazine giving his sort of end of year review of President Obama and applauding him for what he calls bravery in fronts like health care reform. But Joe, where would you say that President Obama has fallen short?
Where has he fallen short? Well, obviously, there are a number of things that he could have done that would have made him more popular, but also needed to be done. He could have been a lot stricter when it came to managing the government. He needed the kind of reinventing government plan that Clinton had. He needed to convince the American public that he wasn't about wasting money. Well, I think that in terms of financial reform, regulatory reform, he could have been more populist. He could have he could have sided against the Wall Street the Wall Street gang, and called for stricter regulations.
You also write in one of your columns earlier in the month, and it seemed to me, and maybe this is my perception, that you seem to criticize Obama in that case for not being brave enough in his speech regarding the Afghan surge, for not asking Americans to make more sacrifices. Have I got
absolutely
that right?
Yeah. I think that the Afghan policy is something that nobody really loves, just as nobody really loves a massive health care reform bill that is churned through the legislative meat grinder of a mature democracy. But I thought that Obama sold that a bit too grudgingly, that when you send troops off to war, you need to do it not by comparing the war in Afghanistan to America's economic needs, which he did, but by saying this is something that we have to do to protect ourselves. And furthermore, here's what we can do to help support the troops. And I would have called for a war tax, as Democrats in the House of Representatives are calling for, to pay for the thing.
Right. You feel, and I'm looking at your words here, that it could have been a moment where a leader could have said to the country, we're trying to prevent the collapse of a nuclear state, Pakistan. We're trying to capture and kill the people who massacred our friends on September 11th. You have to be part of this effort. And
right.
You didn't say that, yeah.
Oh. Right, and in fact, that has been one of the one of the big problems that American presidents who have all these photo ops standing in front of troops and calling Americans to support our troops, it's been a problem with their presentation because they never actually call in Americans to support the troops. And in this case, there are all kinds of worthy charities that could help the troops and their efforts, in Afghanistan, like, Greg Mortensen's effort to build schools there.
Well, the president, when asked to list off his successes, I think it was in the Washington Post, he lists the bill, very early on in his administration, bill to ensure equal pay, to expand hate crime categories, to extend health care to millions of kids, I think 4 million more children, mm-hmm. Place stronger restrictions on tobacco products, implement some consumer credit card protections. His advisors comparing his first year to Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I think that the biggest thing that we're missing here in this conversation is the most important thing he did, which was to prevent a depression. He continued Bush's policies, to bail out the banks, which were, odious, but necessary, and the stimulus program that he passed through the Congress really has taken the edge off of what could have been a real disaster. Now, unemployment levels are still too high, and the financial system is still not regulated nearly enough. But it's hard for politicians to take credit by saying, well, things could have been worse, but in this case, things could have really been terrible. Well, and his action prevented that from happening.
Well, most analysts
agree. That's the big thing domestically. The big thing in foreign policy is that he turned around the unilateralism and militarism of the Bush years. I think that those are two enormous achievements.
Well, most analysts would agree with you. But what about the perception? What about the politics of all of this? Because, of course, the Republicans' drumbeat is deficit, spending too much money. And a lot of people, as you said, aren't feeling that rescue quite yet. They're still out of work. So is there going to be perhaps, you know, winning the war but losing big battles coming up?
Well, I think he's in a difficult political position. But then, you know, this is part of a long-term pattern that Democratic presidents have. Their first years tend to be less popular in their first years than Republicans, because they try and do difficult things like health care reforms. Republicans come in and they cut taxes, or they go to war, or they do things that, you know, that are easily explained. You know, Obama's playing a long game here, not just with his foreign policy, which, if it pays off, will pay off over the long term. It's not like going to Baghdad in 3 weeks, but also in his domestic policy. You know, the healthcare reform won't even take effect until 2014. But you know, he's doing it for what he believes is the long term best interest of the country. And I think that, you know, after 30 years of a conservative pendulum swing, the country is ready for a discreet and very careful implementation of, you know, some progressive programs.
Joe Klein of Time Magazine, we just have a little over a minute left. I want to ask you about something fascinating that you also wrote, which is your observation that Barack Obama doesn't have a second, I don't know how else to say that, a Kissinger, a Cheney. Some people would say that's a good thing. But what point were you making about what you hope to see him do in the future?
Well, I think that one personal style problem that he has as president is his relative isolation. This is a guy who is very much a loner, and most of the successful presidents in recent history, in fact, some of the successful presidents as well, they've always had an alter ego, especially in foreign policy, which requires an incredible amount of detail work that, you know, presidents as human beings are just simply incapable of. Obama doesn't have that. He doesn't have it in domestic policy either. He's trying to do all of this by himself. That's going to take a toll over time.
Joe Klein, Time Magazine, reviewing the year for President Barack Obama. I'm always reminded of the Onion headline when he won a year ago, Joe. Black man wins worst job in world. An incredible year passed. And Joe, thanks for weighing in on it for us.
Okay, my pleasure, Rob.
Coming up, we'll hear from family members in the U.S. of a man detained in Iran, and not for the first time. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Iranian officials are blaming the West for fomenting anti-government protests in Tehran on Sunday. The streets of Tehran have been quiet since then. On that day, state police opened fire on protesters, killing up to 13 people, but Iranian officials have been busy arresting hundreds of opposition supporters since. Among the detained is Dr. Ibrahim Yazdi, a founder of the prominent Freedom Movement of Iran, which was born in the late 1950s and played a role in the overthrow of the Shah of Iran in the 70s. In fact, Yazdi was the new Islamic Republic's first foreign minister, but he resigned less than a year later because he opposed the takeover of the U.S. embassy in 1979. And today, he opposes the current regime. We've been hearing today from members of Yazdi's family living in America, including two of his sons. Joining us now is Ibrahim Yazdi's son-in-law, Dr. Mehdi Norbash. He's associate professor of international affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. It's in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Norbash, you're married to a daughter of Dr. Yazdi. Have you spoken to him or heard anything about him since he was arrested early yesterday morning?
No, unfortunately, we did not, and we tried in the last 2-3 days to find out where he is detained, and unfortunately, we don't have any information. And as you know, Robin, they arrested his very young niece, who is a university activist, and at the same time, in the middle of the night, around 2:30 in the morning, they arrested both of them, and of course, they arrested her from her house.
So your father-in-law, his niece, are both detained, and we understand her father was detained a while back and is still in custody. This isn't the first time your father-in-law has been arrested for anti-government activities. It's actually his fourth. But does it feel different to you? Or
this time is very different. The government is absolutely desperate to prevent the protests and opposition from expanding. And it is expanding very rapidly. And one of the things that this time happened after the June election is a deep fragmentation within the elite in Iran. We are talking about the clerics. The majority of them at the moment are against the current regime. The intellectuals, all of them. We are talking about the religious nationalists. We are talking about all of those middle class educated. And in the forefront of the battle at the moment are the university students. The society is so much at the moment polarized that this time is very different from the previous uprisings.
So as a family that's in the opposition, this has got to be a double-edged view for you, because on the one hand, you feel, and we've heard from others as well, that this opposition is strong and maybe different from other times. On the other hand, that puts your family members in more jeopardy.
Yeah, but everybody has to sacrifice something, of course, when you are in the midst of a change, transformation. And this is, I think, the sacrifice that our family has to offer.
Yeah. Well, tell us more about the role of your father-in-law in all of this, because it's complicated. It's not exactly black and white.
Yes, you are absolutely right. My father-in-law was very active in the United States. He was a cancer researcher over in the U.S. and a university professor before he left.
This was before the Iranian Revolution. And as we said, he became very disillusioned with the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. He was against the takeover of the U.S. Embassy, against the hostage taking. I want to listen to a clip of him speaking on The Daily Show. This was this summer, just a couple of days before he was arrested back then. And this was, of course, around the election. Daily Show correspondent Jason Jones was in Iran and spoke to him. Let's listen.
I am opposing American deeds in Iran. I'm opposing American policy towards Iran. I think that the American religions actually help the hardliner in Iran. The former President Bush called Iran the axis of evil.
So, Dr. Norbash, again, the son-in-law of Dr. Yazdi, and we just heard from him. Here he's saying that he's opposing some of the American policies that he seems to indicate come from some religious basis, President Bush calling Iran the axis of evil. But what does he oppose in his own government?
In his own government, of course, from the beginning, he was against the radicalism in Iran. He was against the hostage shaking. He was against the continuation of the war. He was against all of the political separation from the beginning.
But does he oppose an Islamist government? Does
he is absolutely for the separation of religion from government. And he is very much for political freedom, political parties, civic society, very much for all of those issues.
Well, what impact do you think the events of this week will have on Iran's relations with the West? President Obama has given Iran an end-of-the-year deadline to abide by Western demands for its nuclear program or face additional sanctions. So how do you think this week is going to impact that standoff, especially given that Iran is already saying they think the West is interfering?
Yeah. Overall, this is my argument that the West is concerned about the nuclear program of Iran. But believe me, as long as a type of authoritarian regime stays in Iran, that is a continuing type of debate in Iran. But if the West, helps the Iranians, I'm talking about morally, to establish a type of democratic regime, then there are checks and balances, and you can take care of that issue.
What do you think your father-in-law is doing right now? He's sitting in a jail cell. He's been there before.
Yeah. He's sitting over there, of course, and he's a cancer survivor himself. And because of some health complications that he has to be continuously in a sanitary environment. And that is what makes the whole family very, very concerned at the moment. If he is in an insanitary environment for a couple of hours, he gets infection. And that makes, of course, the whole family worried. Not the jail itself, but the complication that, you know, he has to face.
Dr. Mehdi Norbash, Associate Professor of International Affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Also the son-in-law of Dr. Ibrahim Yazdi, who has been detained in Iran. He was one of the founders of the prominent freedom movement of Iran. Dr. Norbash, thanks so much for talking to us about your father-in-law.
Robin, thank you for having me.
Okay, taking a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, editor and publisher of the magazine that covered the newspaper business for more than a century is shutting down. Also, Bill Littlefield of Only a Game with the best sports reads of 2009. That and a lot more for you tomorrow. Still ahead today, a young soldier grows up fast. After the latest news, Here and Now. The Celtic Tiger is hardly roaring anymore. Ireland's economy was once the fastest growing in Europe, but over the past couple of years, as the world's economy went, so went Ireland's. This month, the Irish government released a severe budget that slashes welfare spending and pay for public sector workers. The BBC's Mike Thompson reports from Dublin.
The city's sleek and shiny yellow-striped trams glide through these streets, reeking sophistication and continental charm. But like horse-drawn carriages and fur-coated film stars, they now seem out of place in this new, devalued Dublin.
I think what we're going to see in Ireland is a substantial increase in poverty. We're seeing that already. People with children are going to be tipped more and more into poverty in particular. And probably what you're going to see is something I never thought I would see again in my lifetime, which is emigration starting up again. What the government would say is, making all these cuts is great because we're going to restore confidence to the economy. I just don't see confidence being restored by poverty and by emigration.
Fintan O'Toole, veteran columnist on the Irish Times, believes the government has been working hard to deflect blame for its handling of the economy onto an allegedly underperforming and overpaid public sector.
They know people are very disillusioned, very bitter, that there's a lot of unfocused rage. And they did quite a clever job of focusing that rage and focusing it in particular on the public service. So there's been a very clever and successful attempt to reshape the agenda. And I think that has certainly had a big impact on the public mood.
Have you had your dinner yet?
Yep.
Okay, how about you, Rosalind?
Yeah, I did.
So listen, Kieran, are you doing hockey in the morning?
Anne English, who's been a teacher for 26 years, gets together with her family at their home in South Dublin. She, too, believes that over the last 18 months, public sector workers here have been unfairly blamed for all the country's ills.
I'm absolutely incensed. I feel maligned, I feel vilified. We've been subjected to the most effective smear campaign in the history of the state.
Anne English claims that after having her salary cut last year and then again in the latest budget, she's now €300 a fortnight worse off. This loss, she says, is compounded by fast-rising gas, electricity and health bills. And after 26 years of hard work, during which time Mrs. English has funded some classroom materials herself, she simply had enough.
When I went into a classroom day one, it was very, very poorly resourced. I got a box of chalk at first morning break, that was it, a few library books later on. Most of the funding for the classroom came out of my pocket, and I did do that because it gave me personal job satisfaction and, you know, I would have a strong sense of moral purpose. I'm not willing to go back to those days where I would be cutting up cornflakes boxes to make work cards for children.
Not far from the centre of Dublin, Father Peter McVary is surrounded by troubled-looking teenagers. Many are homeless drug addicts, some already mothers or fathers. Yet Father McVary says these youths are now finding life even harder than ever, thanks to cuts in dole money, child benefits and a host of other social services.
Those who have wealth have not been touched by this budget. There is no wealth tax in this country, there is no property tax in this country. Instead, it's the poor people. Single parents all taking hits.
But Father McVary, who's been helping Dublin's homeless youngsters for more than three decades, says the years of the Celtic Tiger economy weren't much better for many.
The number of homeless people, for example, during the Celtic Tiger doubled. One in 11 children in this country still remained in consistent poverty, and our prisons were more crowded than ever in the history of the state.
Crowds of festive shoppers lug groaning carrier bags along one of central Dublin's busiest streets, defying a so-called slash-and-burn budget and the chill of recession. Testament, the Irish government might say, to its early success in restoring optimism and self-belief. But trouble could be on the way if this feeling isn't shared soon by the country's many have-nots.
The BBC's Mike Thompson, reporting from Dublin. Well, just ahead, a young U.S. soldier's story. That's after a very quick break, here and now. On his 17th birthday, Private First Class Ian Fisher announced he was going to join the Army. His dad had served in Vietnam. Ian liked to fight, so he thought, with perhaps the wisdom of a 17-year-old, why not join the Army? He enlisted right after graduating from high school, but after basic training, he was stationed near his Colorado home at Fort Carson, and he came home a lot to party with friends. A subsequent substance abuse problem almost got him kicked out of the military. But Ian went into treatment and got a second chance, and then shipped off to Iraq for a year. His story was documented by photojournalist Craig Walker of the Denver Post. Craig Walker joins us, as does Ian Fisher, who is back from Iraq now and serving with the 2nd Brigade Combat Team in the 4th Infantry Division at Fort Carson in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Private First Class Fisher, can I call you Ian?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Craig Walker of the Denver Post is speaking to us from KGNU Community Radio in Denver. Craig, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Robin. It's nice to be here.
Craig, how would you synopsize the story that you captured?
With Ian being stationed at Fort Carson for a year in between basic training and deployment, being so close to home and so close to his friends, while it was a story about a high school graduate becoming a soldier, it's also a story about a young man growing up.
And Ian, was it hard reading some of that? I mean, not many of us get to read, you know, our passage from adolescence to adulthood and have a photojournalist there. Was it hard to read that late night party with a girlfriend or the first time you were driving the Humvee in Iraq and almost drove into a canal? Was it hard to read some of those rites of passage?
I believe at times, but the story was definitely an amazing blessing, because without the story, I don't think I would have been able to realize too much about myself rather than being interviewed every month.
It was sort of like being forced to be introspective.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that really helped my life.
Let's go back to, you know, we see you go to basic training, and there were these moments, you know, obviously where you were learning. You forget to knock on a superior's door, you just walk right in, and he sends you back out again. Mm-hmm. But then you're standing around with some combat vets, and they're talking about, I think it's avoiding explosives or something, and you say something about, wow, that might be cool. What did they say to you?
My old squad leader, he's my first squad leader when I got to the unit, and as punishment, he made me write a list of every soldier that has died in OIF and OEF.
Oh, yeah.
Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom.
Uh-huh. And in fact, he told you to write the list. What did you do at first?
I printed them off the internet.
Typical young person. But then he made you go back and handwrite.
Yes.
What did that experience do for you? You know, as you wrote these names, yours could have been one of them.
Well, to be honest with you, I was just so new to the military that I didn't think too deeply into what I was actually doing and seeing the names that I was actually seeing.
Does it mean something more to you now, having been in combat?
No, of course.
Well, Craig Walker, you're watching a lot of this and writing about it and taking pictures. You watch him through basic training. He sprains his ankle at one point, and so he's making a lot of trips home. He's taking painkillers. His dad is worried about it. Are you worried in this point of the story as well?
Yeah, I had, you know, there were probably two points in the story that I stressed out about where it was going to go. One of them was at basic training while Ian was going through processing. He had fallen one night and banged his elbow and gone for an x-ray, and I guess had a conflict with a drill sergeant for not asking permission to go and get the x-ray. But, you know, it seemed at the time he saw the injured elbow as an opportunity to get out of his contract with the Army. And I was looking at Ian and all the soldiers in the Army. It's a very high-stress situation, like when they get off that bus and there's sleep deprivation, culture shock. You know, I think I made my favorite picture at that point as well.
Which was that?
It's a picture of Ian sitting in the recruiter liaison's office. He's sitting in a chair and he's in his fatigues and his head is freshly shaved. You know, there's the classic Uncle Sam poster that says, "I want you for the U.S. Army." And Ian sort of got his elbow cradled on his lap. It just spoke volumes to me about second thoughts on joining the Army for anyone, you know, obviously not just for Ian, because while I was, you know, watching Ian go through all this, I was watching an entire platoon plus going through the same thing.
Right. Ian, you know, we're wondering, you said at one point you felt like you were made out of glass, you know, things are starting to shatter, your elbow, your ankle, and you got in a little too deep with painkillers, and at one point had to go into a drug abuse program for that. Did you think at a certain point, I'm not going to make it?
There have been a few times throughout my military career that I've thought that.
Yeah. How did you make it?
Usually when I was either in pain mentally or physically, I always had my father, who is my biggest lifeline, even now.
And your dad was the one who knew that you were about to get in trouble with drugs and help steer you towards some help. One of your colleagues, one of the older veterans, is quoted in the Denver Post saying, "Every once in a while, somebody trips up, and I firmly believe that if you can help that guy pick himself up, dust himself off, take a look in the mirror, and chalk it up as a learning experience, I'd say 8 times out of 10, that person's going to turn around and do well." Ian Fisher's one of those cases. Is that how you see yourself?
I think so. When I was switched over to a different platoon before we left for Iraq, they definitely gave me a true second chance, and they were there for me, and I think that's what I needed.
That's Private First Class Ian Fisher speaking to us from Fort Carson, where he's serving with the 2nd Brigade Combat Team and the 4th Infantry Division after having served in Iraq. We've also been speaking with Craig Walker of the Denver Post, who documented Ian's transition from a 17-year-old to the 20-year-old that he is now, which seems still awfully young to us. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're following news about the suspected Christmas bomber for you. Time magazine is reporting that a source close to his family is saying that it was an alleged threat from 23-year-old Nigerian student Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib to blow up an American plane that prompted his father to warn the U.S. Embassy about him back in October. Time asks why Muttalib wasn't banned in the U.S., but rather placed on a low-level watch list. And government officials in Yemen are asking why they weren't told about him. Muttalib studied in Yemen as recently as this month. Yemeni officials say they're tightening up student visas as a result. And finally, Republicans are criticizing the Obama administration for not acting fast enough to put someone in charge of the Transportation Security Administration. Former FBI agent Errol Suther's nomination to head the TSA has been pending since September, but South Carolina Republican Senator Jim DeMint is the one who placed a hold on it due to concerns that Suthers would let airport screeners join a labor union. We'll keep following this story and be back in about a minute with the New Yorker magazine Here and Now. Bad economies are at least good for a laugh. In an office meeting, the boss tells his employees, "We're still the same great company we've always been, only we've ceased to exist." A Wall Street fat cat flicks a few coins into the cup of a beggar and tells him, "Don't say it never trickled." A morose man in a bar complains to the bartender, "I feel like a man trapped in a woman's salary." These are cartoons ripped from the headlines and gathered in the new book On the Money, The Economy in Cartoons, 1925 to 2009, Cartoons from the New Yorker. They're compiled by New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. We'll have many at our website, hereandnow.org, as we welcome Bob from his office in New York. Welcome.
Happy to be here. You know, the stuff we rip from the headlines, we very carefully paste the headlines back. because people, especially around the office, when they still read newspapers here, they get upset.
Ba-dum-bum. Well, what was your sense as you put these together and, you know, watched cartoons over the decades?
Well, I mean, I think that humor is really an insight into how everybody looked at the world and certainly, you know, at the economy. It's the voice of the people that remains after all the white papers disappear. You know, you look at a period, the present period, during the, you know, the last financial crisis, and one of the things is there's always a crisis, you know, before that. I mean, back in, I think, 1989, I did a cartoon in which a guy is at a bank saying, I'd like a hedge fund against my hedge fund. You know, another one, because the first derivative crisis happened in the 80s, and, you know, there was a cartoon in which the CEO is saying, a billion is 1,000 million. Why wasn't I informed of that? So I think humor does give an insight into the perennial nature both of these crises and also of our own credibility, gullibility, and complicity in them.
Well, and what we couldn't help but notice is that so many, unless you told us what decade they were, you really wouldn't know. So, for instance, on page 109, you have one from the 1960s. It's a man on a ledge. Men on ledges are popular pictures in economy cartoons. It's not a funny subject, but somehow you make it so. And here, all his coworkers leaning out the windows telling him, but sir, many analysts consider this only a long overdue correctional movement, following which the market will resume its upward course, with a rally expected to penetrate previous Dow Jones highs by the year's end. And then you turn to the 70s, another man on a ledge, and somebody seems to be doing the same thing, handing something out to him like some good news, and the man on the ledge is saying, are you sure this isn't just a technical rally?
Well, one of the interesting things, of course, everybody knows that, or the cliche anyway, that tragedy plus time equals comedy, but the first ledge cartoons did not actually occur till around 1960 or maybe 1959, I think, might have been the first one, which is a full 30 years after people had actually used those ledges.
So it took a while before people could see that was funny.
I mean, humor always requires some sort of distance because it's actually almost always about something that's bad. Good times don't need humor.
Right, you're having fun already. Well, I'm looking in the 30s. We see a drawing of a couple dozen stockbrokers. They're throwing their hats in the air, dancing around a room, celebrating. And the caption says, turning of the tide. A brokerage house receives an order to buy 10 shares of Goldman Sachs.
Right, right. That's a great Ray Irvin drawing. Wonderful black and white drawing. And there's actually a really interesting cartoon. It has a guy in prison, right? And he's saying, Sunday at 2 p.m., baseball game, trustees versus Wall Street. So that shows you, because when that crash happened, just like the crash happened here, that there were congressional hearings and a number of businessmen ended up in jail.
Well, some would say not as many today as possibly should be, but there he is in jail with the baseball game.
But a cartoon I really like from the 30s, which is actually tells you a lot about the social mores of the time. It's on page 25. It's two middle-aged gentlemen, and in back is a mistress, obviously. A beautiful woman languorously lying on a divan, smoking. And the man is saying to the other man, I never told her about the Depression. She would have worried. Now, that cartoon is from 1934. Now, that's very interesting because if you look at stock market charts, from 32 to 34, there was a really big rebound in the market, and people thought the Depression was over.
And we now know it wasn't.
It wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, one of the things you also is you see the sexual stereotypes that existed at this time and maybe to some extent still exist.
Well, I think the one that I mentioned about the man bemoaning that he's a man trapped in a woman's salary, that's on page 239. That's in the 2000s. It sort of flips that.
Right, right. Well, it flips that, but it recognizes the problem. I mean, I would call that satire.
What are some of the other overarching things that we take from seeing them all the way through?
You're looking at the actual economy and how people reacted to it. So in a cartoon from 1974, you'll see a guy at a dinner table saying to his wife and family, because of inflation, I'm going to have to let three of you go. Because inflation really was rampant. One of the overarching themes, of course, is how much money is intertwined with our self-evaluation. And, you know, it makes the wheels of society go around, no matter how much we would like that not to be the case.
Well, it also lets you get at the bad guys or what you perceive are the bad guys. A recent cartoon shows two executives, Wall Street executives, sitting at a desk. One says, these new regulations will fundamentally change the way we get around them.
I think the ridicule here is sort of corrective and not particularly mean because, well, it's not personal. These are general villains, not particular ones. They're not editorial cartoons.
But what about in the 90s? Because in the 90s, everybody was in love with their brokers. I mean, all the people who were doing well, that is. And I'm just wondering, what do we... I'm looking at some of the cartoons from the 90s. Here's two down-and-out guys, sort of, and one says to the other, there it is again, the invisible hand of the marketplace giving us the finger.
Well, but remember, not everybody was in love with their broker, especially the people on the outs. Also, even then, as things were booming, the vulnerability of everything was recognized, and also our vulnerability. So, I mean, there's a cartoon from the 90s I'm looking at where two guys looking at a computer screen and one is saying, up 116 points, if only we had the foresight to invest 10 minutes ago. I mean, what was being asked of us was a certain faith, and then we were naive enough to think that we could ride that wave. So you have a cartoon, I think, also in the late 90s where it's a roller coaster, and the roller coaster is just not called the cyclone or anything like that. It's called the day trader.
Oh, right. And there's another roller coaster where the maybe that's the same one where the caption reads, down Jonesy enough for you?
Right. That's a wonderful Jack Ziegler cartoon. Beautiful drawing. So, I mean, I think one of the things is the cartoons, they are poking fun at ourselves. You know, I often think that a lot of the humor that appears elsewhere is, the humor of self-satisfaction. And I think a lot of the New Yorker cartoons are the humor of self-dissatisfaction.
Yeah. A couple last ones. A man is heading out the door. He's got a ski mask over his face. He says to his wife, need anything from the bank? And another, a Wall Street executive at his desk, huge picture window. He sees outside the window a huge shoe dropping from the sky.
Right.
Yeah, the caption reads, hold everything.
Right, hold everything. I mean, there's a wonderful cartoon in the 70s. It was one of my favorite Sam Gross cartoons. This was, I think, from 74. It shows a guy. It's Wall Street, and right on top of the Wall Street sign is Humpty Dumpty.
Ready to slip off and shatter. That's New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. He compiled the new book, On the Money, The Economy in Cartoons, 1925 to 2009, Cartoons from the New Yorker. We'll have many of the cartoons at our website, hereandnow.org. Bob Mankoff, thanks as always.
Well, it was a real pleasure.